concluding the sutta. Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, or, if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone 7 years, bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 3 years, for 2 years, for 1 year, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or, if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone for 1 year, bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 7 months, for 6 months, for 5 months, for 4 months, for 3 months, for 2 months, for 1 month, for half a month, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone half a month, bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or, if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. So it was with reference to this that it was said, bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely, the four foundations of mindfulness. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Short of enlightenment, the two great turning points, as far as this concluding section of the sutta is concerned, are the point of stream entry, when one has gone beyond any possibility of falling back into a lower form of existence upon rebirth, and the point of non-returning. In the early Buddhist scheme of things, the non-returner is said never to return to life as a human being, but to be born in a group of worlds called the Shuddhavasa, the pure abodes, which are situated at the highest point of the realm of form, the Rupa Loka. Beyond these lies only the realm of infinite space. Buddhist cosmology correlates these various realms with the stages of meditative absorption, or dhyanas. One might think of meditation as being simply an internal subjective experience, but the Buddhist tradition is that once one has become absorbed in these subtler modes of consciousness, one also gains entry to an external world which is their objective correlative, not any material world, but one that is subtle and more ethereal. One can bypass this model and say simply that as your consciousness becomes more refined, discriminative awareness rises to ever higher levels. But according to Buddhist tradition, it is no less valid to say that with entry into the dhyanas, you enter what are called the deva, or god realms. Initially, you enter the Rupaloka, the world of pure form, where your experience is purely an awareness of light. The mystical writings of many religious traditions contain references to this. Sometimes the image of light is used symbolically, but sometimes it is an actual description of the mystic's perception of a kind of subtle brilliance, and corresponds with many people's experience of dhyana. The pure abodes are five in number, the not great, aviha, the unscorched, atapa, the clearly visible, Sudasa, the clear-visioned, Sudasi, and the greatest or highest, Akanita, said in the Lankavatara Sutra to be resplendent with light. Having left the gross material plane behind, the non-returner moves upwards from one subtle plane to another until the goal of enlightenment is reached, never taking another human birth. In the devotional Buddhism of the Mahayana Pure Land schools, the figure of the non-returner appears in a slightly different form. Through devotion to Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, one aspires to be reborn in the pure land of Sukhavati, the realm over which Amitabha presides. From here, as from the pure abodes, one attains enlightenment directly, without being born again in any of the lower realms. According to the Pure Land schools, however, the devotee attains rebirth not due to his or her own merits, but due to the power of Amitabha's original vow, as contrasted with the non-returner of the early Buddhist tradition, who reaches the pure abodes by virtue of the momentum of spiritual practice generated during his or her last human existence. This is the essential doctrinal difference between early Buddhism and the Mahayana Pure Land schools. Inasmuch as the Pure Land is inhabited by beings on the transcendental path, it is not really part of the mundane world system at all. And although the jhanas, however refined they may be, are still within mundane experience, even a substantial experience of the fourth dhyana is insufficient to assure one's rebirth there. In fact, dhyana is a feature only of the pure abodes in that, as the product of shamatha meditation, it provides the concentration necessary to break the remaining fetters and gain transcendental insight. But even though it is difficult to see how the pure abodes can be thought of as mundane, in the sense of being worlds into which beings are born and from which they pass away, in early Buddhism they are said quite clearly to be a subdivision of the Rupa Loka, the world of form. Thus, it is difficult to say whether the pure abodes are mundane or transcendental. But we need not get too caught up in questions of cosmology. The important thing is to get some sense of the nature of the further reaches of the Buddhist path. Buddhism can seem to be all lists, the five of this, the six of that, and the stages of a path beyond stream entry can seem like just another one. Stream entrant, once returner, non-returner, arahant. Furthermore, this list might create the impression that these stages are quite close and follow easily upon one another. Nothing could be further from the truth. Words can scarcely capture the immense distance between stream entry and the higher stages of the transcendental path. In the Buddha's original teaching, at least in its earlier phases, what afterwards came to be known as stream entry constituted the real turning point in one's spiritual life. Subsequent stages of attainment seem to have been elaborated later and were not defined so precisely. Even the arahant ideal does not emerge very clearly at that stage of the teaching, no doubt because it is unimportant compared to the overriding need to break the first three fetters and thus enter upon the transcendental path. Characteristically, very little is said about the goal in this final part of the sutta. The sutta says, either final knowledge here and now is to be attained, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. This suggests that while it is necessary to have a clear sense of the goal, the Buddha placed greater emphasis on the path as a means to enlightenment than on descriptions of the goal to which that path led. According to the Mahayana text called the Ashta Sahasrika Pranyaparamita Sutta, or Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, one of the hallmarks of an irreversible bodhisattva, that is, a bodhisattva who can never fall back from spiritual progress, is the fact that they are not concerned about whether or not they have reached that stage. Whatever your level of spiritual attainment, you don't have to be constantly analysing your progress. As the days and weeks go by, you will feel intuitively that you are becoming spiritually more alive. You will see the little knots of habit and attachment breaking up as you become steadily less attached to material things, less easily upset by what others say and so on. Here, at the conclusion of the sutta, the reiteration of the point that, quote, the way of mindfulness is the direct way, unquote, takes on a new significance. It is as though, by its very nature, mindfulness ensures a gradual acceleration of the whole spiritual process, if you put enough effort into it. One should not forget that the Buddha is speaking here to a group of monks who have gone forth from the household life and have very good conditions for spiritual practice. Some of his listeners would no doubt be able to make swift and effective use of this teaching. At the same time, the Buddha says, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, rather than saying, if any monk should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, thereby implying that although they are a full-time exercise, it is possible for anyone to practice them. There is no reason for a layperson to hold back from so doing. Whether you are male or female, a member of the monastic community or not, how soon you arrive at the goal will depend entirely on the intensity of your effort. The important message is that you don't necessarily have to spend years working away at developing mindfulness to get anywhere. Indeed, the sutta seems to suggest that 7 years is rather a long time. By intensifying your effort, you can reduce the length of time required to reach the goal. Even 7 days is not too short a time, it would appear. The recurrence of the symbolic number 7 suggests that it is not to be taken literally. But we can take it that substantial spiritual progress can be made, more or less from scratch, within a few years, and certainly within the present lifetime. There is no limit to the progress you can make if you are single-minded, which is to say, if you can resist the myriad obstructions that the world places in the path of anyone who wants to be single-minded. Ultimately, all the teachings of the Satipatthana Sutta have one end in view: transformation. This goal is approached on the basis of the defining principle of Buddhism that states of consciousness never arise haphazardly but are always the product of definite conditioning factors. To bring about certain results, we have to know the right way to go about changing those conditions. Sometimes this hardly seems possible, and indeed, no amount of pious determination to experience more positive states of mind will achieve it. If we want to bring about certain mental states, we have to be clear about how those states actually arise. Our habitual modes of mental activity seem to plough on through the ways of life like some enormous ocean liner, regardless of our best intentions. But even the supposedly unsinkable Titanic sank, though it took an iceberg to sink it. In the same way, even the same drastic way, mindfulness can bring a halt to our unskillful mental and emotional states. We need to learn to monitor our states of consciousness much more closely and in much greater detail than people usually do. It isn't enough just to keep up a vague general awareness. We need to scrutinize our mental state almost from moment to moment, and we can use the classes of mental objects outlined by the sutta to help us to do this. You can call to mind, say, the 7 bojangas, and ask yourself whether in your mind at this moment there is greed, aversion or delusion, or investigation of mental states, or mindfulness itself. These latter two qualities are obviously present to some extent, given that you are asking yourself these questions. An encouraging thought. In this way, you can cultivate the conditions for a continuous development of awareness. Work on the mind really is work, and full-time work too, both in meditation and outside it. The sutta advises us to carry on contemplating our minds whatever we are doing, walking, standing, or lying down. And this is no mere pious exhortation. The Buddha left nothing unclear. The sutta provides everything we need. We are told exactly what to do, and exactly how to go about doing it. If we have learned anything from the Satipatthana Sutta, we have surely gathered that maintaining mindfulness is no easy task, especially to begin with. But once you are on your way, mindfulness becomes steadily easier to sustain, especially if you have the moral support of your spiritual friends and indeed the whole spiritual community. As you go on, mindfulness demands progressively less effort, in contrast to the slow, painful process it is sometimes made out to be. You find yourself treading a path of ever-growing clarity and delight. Immersing yourself in a flow of positive and creative states, you come to get a feeling for the, quote, direct way towards which this sutta steers us, and thus focus and refine your efforts towards growth. By remaining sensitive to the nature of the path and the extent to which our mental states help or hinder our spiritual growth, we can direct our consciousness towards skillful states of mind. Once we have acknowledged that mundane consciousness is an ever-changing, conditioned phenomenon, through the practice of mindfulness, we can steer that change in the direction of the highest spiritual and moral perfection. And the key to all this is provided by the succinct words of the Satipatthana Sutta, in which we can hear an echo of the Buddha's original intention when he addressed the bhikkhus on that day in Kamasadhamma. Like the bhikkhus on that occasion, we have every reason to be satisfied and to delight in the Blessed One's words. The End of Living with Awareness by Sangharakshita.